From the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the interns take over. We'll bring you some of the reporting from our spring and summer interns, including river safety on the Delaware River.
The river is very deceiving. So the river levels fluctuate. There's literally spots where it's inches deep, you know, especially at lower normal water levels. And then you can walk literally halfway across the river, and then all of a sudden you have a 10, 15 foot hole where it suddenly drops off. And it can be very deceiving, especially, you know, the deeper parts of the river, it looks calm. It looks placid. It looks like a pool.
And Choi Commons, a cooperative of Asian-led farms in the Hudson Valley.
This really was to create that bridge between two generations, right? Between our elders and you know, young farmers today.
All that and more. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. More than 10,000 hotel workers are on strike in the U.S. on this Labor Day. Housekeepers, front desk, and restaurant staff walked off the job at major hotels in several cities on Sunday. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports more union members are expected to join the picket lines today.
These strikes, each lasting up to 3 days, are targeting hotels operated by Hyatt, Hilton, and Marriott. Workers in Boston, San Francisco, San Diego, Honolulu, and elsewhere are demanding higher wages and fairer staffing. They complain that although hotel occupancy has largely recovered since COVID, staffing has not, resulting in heavier workloads. In some cities, their union Unite Here is still fighting to restore daily room cleaning, which became optional during the pandemic. Hotels in Southern California faced similar walkouts last year. They brought in staff from other properties and curtailed some services like housekeeping and dining. That labor dispute ended with raises for workers of 40% to 50% by 2027. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Vice President Kamala Harris is pledging to cut housing costs by ramping up supply. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports on her plan to address a key issue for many voters.
The biggest part of it is to boost our supply of housing. And that really is the core problem. I mean, this country has a severe shortage of especially affordable housing that has pushed up prices. Harris says she would build 3 million new housing units in 4 years. Okay, theoretically, not impossible, but certainly ambitious.
That's NPR's Jennifer Ludden reporting. Meanwhile, Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump has repeatedly spoken out against low-income housing. He says it brings down property values and calls it an attack on suburban areas. Wall Street investors are turning their attention to a critical report on the jobs market this week. NPR's Rafael Nam reports traders are worried about a sharp slowdown in the labor market.
For a long time, the labor market was one of the bright spots of the U.S. economy, but confidence was shaken last month after data showed the labor market slowing more than expected. And then a separate report showed the U.S. had actually created 818,000 fewer jobs than previously estimated for the year ending in March. So the question for investors is whether this is a natural slowdown or whether something more concerning is happening with the economy. We'll get additional clues this week when we get the latest labor market report. It's out on Friday. Rafael Nam, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington. China is pledging to strengthen agricultural and mineral processing cooperation with the Democratic Republic of Congo. The effort is aimed at helping the African nation turn its resource wealth into economic growth. Chinese President Xi Jinping met with leaders ahead of the Ninth Forum on China-African Cooperation, which is set to kick off on Wednesday. Another school year is underway in Ukraine under difficult conditions caused by the ongoing war, with hundreds of schools destroyed and more than 1,500 damaged. NPR's Hanna Palamarenko reports Ukrainian schools are prioritizing face-to-face classes with the option of combining with online learning.
Today, school bells mark the beginning of the school year all over Ukraine. In most regions, if the school has the proper conditions for face-to-face classes, including access to a bomb shelter, children will study in classrooms. This will be the second year that the underground school has been successfully operating in Kharkiv. However, most students will have to combine in-person and distance learning, like 12-year-old Vira Sheremet from Dnipro in central eastern Ukraine.
Because of the war, I'll be attending classes online and offline. My school provides a bomb shelter to hide in during air alerts.
A shortened program of online classes is provided for young Ukrainians who fled abroad. Hanna Polomarenko, NPR News, Kyiv.
I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include BritBox, working to help people discover British dramas and mysteries, including The Responder, starring Martin Freeman, and entire series like Sherlock and Vera. Streaming at BritBox.com/NPR.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Today we're bringing you some of the stories reported by our summer and spring interns. A 39-year-old New Jersey man drowned while trying to save his own kids while swimming in the Delaware River last week near the Delaware River Water Gap. That's the third drowning on the river this summer. If you plan on boating, fishing, or enjoying any water recreation on the Delaware River, you need to be mindful of its depths, which could vary depending on where you enter the water. Radio Catskill reporter and intern Chia Tien Nicole Chen spoke to a National Park Service ranger with tips for a safe time on the water.
Hi, I'm Susie Casper, and I'm a park ranger for the National Park Service at Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River.
So, Susie, I'm always hearing people say that the Upper Delaware is deceiving. What do they mean by that?
The river is very deceiving. So the river levels fluctuate so very much. It's incredible. There's literally spots where it's inches deep, you know, especially at lower normal water levels. And then you can walk literally halfway across the river, and then all of a sudden you have a 10, 15 foot hole where it suddenly drops off. And it can be very deceiving, especially, you know, the deeper parts of the river, it looks calm. It looks placid. It looks like a pool. And that's where most folks have learned to swim, is in a pool or a lake where they're not fighting those natural water features like a fast moving river current. But that's, you know, it's not uncommon to just be in shallow water, and then all of a sudden you take a step or two, and then you're in way over your head in fast-moving water. And we have, unfortunately, had a few drownings where folks didn't know how to swim, but they were only in ankle-deep water, so it wasn't concerning. And then all of a sudden, the next thing you know, you're in over your head and struggling, and you're fighting that current. So we had one fatality last year. Yeah, and then the year before, there was three, unfortunately. So,
is there any pattern to the cause behind these drownings?
Yeah. So in 2011, we had a rash of five drownings in just the matter of 2 months or so. Of course, everybody's very shocked, like, oh my goodness, what's happening? So we really started to look into our statistics, who was drowning, why they were drowning. And we kind of came to the conclusion that more often than not, these folks were actually swimming when the drowning occurred. So they may have been on a boat, but they pulled off to shore and engaged in the activity of swimming. So, you know, anybody, doesn't matter if you're an Olympic swimmer, if you're fighting a current and you're swimming, you're eventually going to get fatigued. So that's why we always encourage, if you're going to swim in the river, just please wear a life jacket. Because at least you, if you're not going to get back to the same spot where you're at, it's going to keep you afloat and you're not going to have any issues there.
Let's talk about that a little more. So say you're swimming in the river and then you suddenly find yourself being swept away by a current. What should you do?
Yeah, the best thing to do, and this is also rule of thumb if your canoe or kayak capsizes, what you want to do is you want to float on your back. People think, well, that seems silly because that's not how you swim. You swim, you know, usually front forward. But the river, because the current moves so fast, it can actually push you into a rock or a log or something like that. And the water moves so fast, you don't realize it. So you don't want your head facing forward. You want your feet to face forward. So you float on your back with your feet pointed towards the sky. Use your arms to steer yourself to shore. And that's the best method. And if you have your life jacket on, it's so much easier because you can just float and you don't have to worry.
So say you're not the person who's caught in current. Maybe you just saw someone in a dangerous situation. Maybe you saw a boat capsize. What should you do as a bystander?
That's really important. I'm really glad you brought that up because we have had many times on the river double drownings. Even if you have a life jacket on and you go in after a drowning person, especially if it's an adult, they can easily pull you underwater because a drowning person, you know, they can't see, they can't hear. They're in the process of drowning. They're obviously not breathing hardly. They can't talk. They are looking to get air. So they will climb on top of you and pull you under. It doesn't matter if you're a parent, a friend, a spouse, that they are just trying to get a breath of air. And so that's when a double drowning can occur. So we always say reach, row, throw, go. So if you can reach for the person, say, and you're in a boat, you can throw them something like a life jacket or the seat cushions for their boats. You can throw them that. You can throw them a rope. It could be literally anything as long as it floats, something they can grab onto. Or, you know, go get help. Because, you know, people can be rescued if they've been underwater for a short amount of time. But if you're not prepared to rescue somebody, don't do it because it could ultimately end in your death as well.
Do you have any tips on how to find the right fitting life jacket?
So here on the Upper Delaware specifically, adults have to have their life jacket with them. Of course, it has to fit. So they all have that Coast Guard label, and it shows how it fits you by your weight or by your chest size. If they're not securely fastened and nice and snug on you, the life jacket can actually come up over your head and then actually can hinder you more than it's going to help you because you can't see. I've actually seen people almost drown inside their life jackets a couple of times because it almost creates more of a hazard. So if it has to be on you and it has to be nice and snug, if it's not, it's not going to help you a whole lot. But for children, we always recommend that, you know, kids grow so fast. So if you're heading out in the water, you know, before the season starts, put them in their life jackets, make sure they fit and they're nice and snug. Also, you know, if they're too small, kids, they get uncomfortable, they're too tight, they don't want to wear them. But it is a requirement that children on the river, when you're underway in a boat, 12 and under, have to be wearing them at all times.
Aside from getting a life jacket, what should people do to prepare for activities on the water?
Oh, there's so many different things. So we just got out of a major heat wave where it was 90 plus degrees, it seemed like every day. But even when it's not super hot, hydration is super important. You know, lots of people like to have an adult beverage on the river, which is okay, as long as you're mixing it with water. You don't realize how much energy you're expelling when you're on the river, especially when it's hot. So having water or sports drinks, you know, to replenish your electrolytes, salty snacks, you know, having, you know, eating a good meal when you're out there. And then of course, you know, sunscreen. We were out there training this past week and we probably applied sunblock. It felt like every 15 minutes because the sun was just so hot and strong. We see people that come out of the river looking like lobsters. So just making sure you're protecting yourself from the elements. That being said too, so yesterday it was, I think like 87 degrees. Today it's a high of 77. So believe it or not, we have more cases of hypothermia in the summer months than we actually do in the winter months because obviously there's more boaters out there, but we all live in the Pocono Mountains in the Sullivan County Catskills, and the weather changes so quickly. So if you find yourself in the water for a prolonged amount of time, and maybe that cool afternoon thunderstorm rolls by, you've only got your bathing suit, it can get really chilly really quickly. Mm-hmm. So that's something super important to keep in mind as well. We recommend folks make sure we say file a float plan, but it's really just letting your family and friends know where you're going and when you expect to return. That way, in case, and of course, we don't recommend boating alone ever, but just in case something happens, you maybe have a raft and your raft might deflate on the side of the river and now you're in a remote spot and nobody can find you. So we want to make sure that people know where you're at and if something should happen, where they can find you. So just being really extra prepared, you know, having medications, bug spray. There was a lot of horseflies out there yesterday, too. So you're kind of in the wilderness. So being prepared to be outdoors for several hours and then some.
And I know that the Park Service has a lot of water safety resources. So could you go through what they are, describe where our listeners can find them?
Yeah, so we have on our website, so it's NPS, so that stands for National Park Service, .gov. /UPDE, and that stands for Upper Delaware. And we have a whole Planning Your River Trip section on our website that gives you all kinds of different tips, how to plan your river trip, what you need to bring, you know, life jacket requirements. The river gauges, which is super important too. It's always super important to know what the river conditions are going to be before you go out there because, you know, where we have heavy rainstorms, the river will rise a couple of feet overnight. And most people are used to being on the river when it's, you know, at a normal level. But, you know, when it reaches, you know, over 5 or 6 feet, the rapids can be quite a bit more dangerous. So our website has a lot of good information. We also post updates when river conditions change on our social media accounts, so Facebook and Instagram, and you can link to those from our website as well.
And you also mentioned earlier that if you see a dangerous situation on the river, you can call someone. Who should we call?
Yeah, so it's tricky in the River Valley because, as we all know, there's not great cell phone service. So the best thing to do is just call 911 because it's not just the Park Service that's out there. We have a lot of volunteer fire companies, you know, local EMS who will respond as well as us. And, you know, as we all know, who, you know, we live in a very remote area, response time can be, it's not going to be 5 minutes. You know, it's going to be a little bit longer than that. So just calling 911 is the best thing to do. And then, of course, our dispatch phone number is also on our website. So for emergencies, you can call them as well. Also, too, I just want to mention that, you know, somebody who's drowning, they can't yell for help. Remember, their esophagus is closed up. They're trying to gasp for air. So it's important when you're out there with the rest of your family and friends, you know, everybody's out there having a great time, but keep an eye on your friends and your family, because we've had many drownings happen when people are all in and out of the water. Then all of a sudden their friend is missing. They didn't even know it until a few minutes later, and that's too late. So keep an eye on your friends and your family. Encourage them to wear their life jackets. You know, it doesn't matter if you're a good swimmer. The river is stronger than you. You know, the river can fatigue even the best of swimmers. So just make sure you have that life jacket. It has to be accessible so that way if somebody is struggling in the water, somebody can quickly throw it to you. Or if your boat capsizes, you know, you have the opportunity to grab onto it.
Yeah, that's key. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know it's been really busy, so.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Really, I really do. If it saves one life, it's worth it.
From Liberty, it's Jiatie Nicole Chen for Radio Catskill.
All of the resources mentioned by Susie Casper in the story can be found at nps.gov/UPDE. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Liberation Farm in Delaware County. This is Radio Chatskill.
Join us for Radio Catskill's 2024 Community Awards, September 12th, honoring individuals dedicated to environmental stewardship and sustainability, including Lori Ramey of the Upper Delaware Council and Lisa Lyons of Morgan Outdoors. Celebrate their hard work and commitment to healthier and more sustainable local communities at the 2024 Radio Catskill Community Awards, September 12th at La Sagone, Narrowsburg. Get your tickets now at wjffradio.org.
Hi, I'm Bill Williams. Join me for the Kingfisher Project tomorrow when my guest will be Bob Lindsay, a lifelong recovery advocate whose work has benefited thousands of his fellow New Yorkers.
Addiction affects all of us, directly or indirectly, and as a result, we all bear some responsibility to do something about it.
That's the Kingfisher Project on the Local Edition, tomorrow night at 6, only on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Today we're bringing you some of the stories reported by our summer and spring interns. Making a living as a small-scale farmer in a system that supports mass production isn't easy. For black farmers, a number of discriminatory barriers have made farming even more challenging. In the last century, black farmers have lost over 90% of the land they once owned, and today just 1% of American farmers are black. Radio Catskill reporter and intern Maren Scotton spoke to Amawale Adewale, the co-owner of Liberation Farm in Delaware County, to discuss his experience getting denied a loan by the USDA and his hopes for a more equitable future in American agriculture.
In a food system that lends itself to large-scale producers, retailers, and corporations, being a small-scale farmer isn't easy. For black farmers, there are even more barriers to making a living growing food. Omawale Adewale is a farmer and co-owner of Liberation Farm, opened in 2021 and is entirely vegan, producing 100% organic food.
What kind of guides us is black food and land sovereignty. So just being able to control, you know, the food that's coming into the community, oftentimes, you know, we'll go out and, you know, maybe want to get okra. You know, and so okra might not be, you know, growing in all the different, you know, spaces, but there might be a lot of some, you know, other particular produce, right? So just having more variety, being, you know, feeling like I want to get sea moss, you know, so I want to have that relationship, you know, with Jamaican farmers, but also it such a connection, you know, just, you know, decades of Jamaican farmers living near, you know, black American farmers, of Black Americans, you're going to find that, you know, that's going to rub off on us. It's going to educate our, you know, our community. So that, you know, our neighborhood is going to need those particular cultural foods that we value. And so that what's kind of, you know, kind of guides us in, you know, in our direction. So this is just having that understanding. We do Black Veg Fest, and we've been doing that since 2018. Cool. And that's just basically trying to take it into our own hands, be accountable. How do we actually, you know, get information, quality food information, you know, to our community, help them make, you know, great decisions, you know, and different options. So we approach veganism, we approach it from a way of giving the information, not necessarily, you know, pushing in, but suggesting that more fruits and vegetables, you know, over animal produce.
Though they've become a pillar in feeding their community, the past couple years haven't been easy for Liberation Farm. Adewale and his wife, Nadia Muib, applied for a Farm Service Agency microloan of $50,000 at the Cortland County Office of the United States Department of Agriculture, also known as the USDA. The microloan program is dedicated to financing the needs of small, beginning farmers, niche and non-traditional farm operations. They needed the money to help pay for a tractor accident the previous summer, on top of other costs. But on November 17th, Liberation Farm was notified they were denied the loan.
So, you know, my wife and I was also, you know, partnering with Liberation Farm. We're 50-50 in our partnership. You know, we both just felt like, you know, like exasperated. It messed with our emotions, you know, quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And it made us feel like we wouldn't be able to do anything. So, and just knowing that this has just been, you know, historic, you know, situation, it's very jarring. And it really makes you call the entire system in, you know, into question.
Adewale and Weeb are not alone in their experience. According to USDA data, from 2018 to 2023, the national rejection average for Farm Service Agency loans, which is an agency of the USDA, was 8%. But for Black farmers, it was 35%. In New York State, the rejection rate was 23% for white farmers, compared to 66% for Black farmers. The USDA has a long and documented history of discrimination towards Black farmers, denying them access to loans, grants, and other forms of assistance, which has contributed to a significant decline in Black-owned farms. In 1920, there were nearly 1 million Black farmers nationwide. Today, there are around 40,000.
It's important to point out for, you know, anyone who, you know, sees this, is that farmers generally will go to the USDA for FSA loan, because it's not a traditional financial institution. And so where that'd be more stringent, you'll harder, you know, for you to get the funds that you need. And of course, you know, if you're in agriculture, you kind of need, you know, those resources for different equipment, you know, food costs, because food has to grow, you know, even if folks are engaged with livestock, it has to grow. So you have to get that, you know, that funding in early.
As a farm season can be so uncertain, access to resources and grants like the FSA loans are crucial to farms staying afloat. Without them, one bad season or accident can take a huge financial toll.
If we don't have the food, you know, as farmers, then cycle. So anytime there's a breakup or a mix up, you know, down there where somebody is, you know, entrepreneur down, and they don't hire that many people, and now their business has to, you know, tank, that food, you know, is then going to just start going to a pantry, go on to the supermarket, you know, again. And so it doesn't become dependable. So now on Black farmers, we can't be dependent upon, you know, by a supermarket. You see, we can't be dependent on by a supermarket,
right?
Because we're not going to get the resources. Almost 100% of the resources go to white farmers who do livestock.
Not wanting to give up, Liberation Farm took their case to the National Court of Appeals. On February 7th, their case was approved for a trial. They hope not only to win the appeal, but that the case will raise awareness and eventually lead to a more equitable future for other Black farmers.
We want publicity, you know, on this particular issue, more publicity on the issue, but we want to make it usable data. So, and when I say usable data, I mean that folks get educated and then they actually make steps to make these particular changes. And so some of these changes could be, you know, really affecting policy. We talk to our legislators, you know, from the local level up to, you know, to ground level as well. Communicate with USDA, join some of these committees, you know, and have a mindset that, you know, we want to at least be more equitable with the distribution of, you know, resources. So that's what we're trying to do. So it's not just for liberation, you know, Liberation Farm. But, you know, for us in the short run, we want to be able to pay our bills. We want to be able to pay our bills. We want to see, you know, that it's more fair assessment that's happening. Race kind of keeps you down, but people think that you want to be there. That's the problem. People think that you want to discuss race. Like, you have to. I feel like my main issue should be like everyone's main issue, which should be focused on climate change. Right now, I'd rather be, you know, discussing climate change, not race. I'd rather be focusing on bees, increasing the bees, but not being a beekeeper, just having more flowers out there, just having more ways to, you know, to grow the bee population and leave the bee population alone. Being able to, you know, just kind of learn more, you know, I feel like I don't know enough. So I want to learn more, you know, about more, you know, fungi. I want to learn more, you know, about horticulture. I want to learn more about these, you know, different elements, you know, what particular plant. I want to go forage and know what to eat and what not to eat. You know, I want to find that, you know, on the land. I want to focus on, you know, cultural, you know, issues. I feel like I can't focus on cultural issues if the political issues keep rearing its head. I would rather focus on, you know, social, you know, bonding, you know, within my community. Would love to, you know, address some of these issues, be able to heal, discuss the pain, you know, that we have generational, you know, issues that are happening, you know, there. But in a cultural setting, in a Black cultural, you know, setting, you know, discussing some of those things and learn more about other cultures and find out about other cultures and see where the similarities are.
Along with winning the appeal, Adewale hopes this year Liberation Farm can continue to provide nutritious food and act as a place of gathering and education for the Black community.
You know, we would love for folks, you know, to support, you know, Black farmers, you know, produce. We, you know, we do a long, you know, list of produce, you know, touch our herbs, our, you know, our tomatoes, you know, we grow beets, you know, we do that because we want to, you know, bring down heart disease. It levels are up. Hypertension. I was diagnosed with hypertension when I was 15 years old. And so just learning, you know, about how to do that, what particular foods that we can use, is important and it's key, you know, more greens. So we do, you know, we do kale, we do, collard greens, you know, red lettuce. You know, it's a number of, you know, foods that, you know, we're looking to grow, this year, including watermelon as well. Talk about the history. So we also, I mean, I think this cultural value in educating folks about the food, you know, why food, you know, exists. There's a reason why tomatoes, you know, was the, you know, first food to be, you know, GMO. So just giving folks that particular education, you know, it's important. Why is, you know, why corn is the number one, you know, produced food, you know, in the U.S. Everything has, there's a context, there's information, you know, and this not to attack any of the, you know, the farmers, but it just shows that who's actually benefiting, you know, and this not to attack any of the, you know, the farmers, but it just shows that who's actually benefiting, you know, who's benefiting from the resources and who's not benefiting from the resources. Even as a downhill, we don't have any businesses in the Black community that's going down where we're still making, you know, lots of money. It's just not a thing. No one does that.
That was Omawale Adewale, the co-owner of Liberation Farm. In Liberty, I'm Marin Scotton for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Choi Commons, a cooperative of Asian-led farms in the Hudson Valley. This is Radio Chatskill.
Many of us fantasize about quitting our jobs and having all the free time in the world. But what if we have more time than we think?
This is important to recognize because it suggests where can we reallocate some of our time so that we can spend more on moments of joy.
How changing the way you think about time can help you find more of it this week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Today at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Mark from the Ambient Barn, your one-stop shop for all things electronic music. I just want to let you know that my show is moving from Sundays at 11 to Fridays at midnight, which is a much cooler slot. Join me every week for another deep dive into the expansive world of electronic music in all its forms. That's the Ambient Barn, Fridays at midnight, here on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Bookmark, a used and rare bookstore in Jeffersonville, adjacent to Tavern on Main, specializing in literature, philosophy, the arts, local authors, gardening, and astrology. Open today, Labor Day, from 2 to 6. More information on Facebook at thebookmark.jeffersonville.ny or at the-book.com. And support comes from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Today we're bringing you some of the stories our interns reported on this spring and summer. Choi Commons is a cooperative of Asian-led farms in the Hudson Valley that runs community programs, cultural events, and a wholesale food program designed to provide affordable, nutritious food for Asian American communities. Radio Catskill reporter and intern Maren Scotton spoke to Larry Tsai and Amanda Wong of Choi Commons about their mission.
Farming can be a lonely career. After farming for 10 years, Larry C. was feeling just that, isolated. As an Asian farmer in a predominantly white farming community, he wanted to connect with others from a similar background. So he started Choi Commons, a cooperative of Asian-led farms.
I think, you know, it's fair to say that the young farmer community is very predominantly white and predominantly comes from a middle-class background, right? Like this generation of people who are interested in farming and nothing against them, right? I'm glad that there are lots of young farmers out here, but they all come from a fairly privileged background and come from a very, very white background. You know, there are very few Asian farms in the Hudson Valley. I mean, you could pretty much, you know, all of each other, right? When you're up here, it's pretty, It's a small community. And so, I had farmed, in the Hudson Valley for a couple of years without really finding that community. And, you know, while I'm glad to have people around me, you know, and I farmed on a piece of land where, you know, it was a group of young farmers, that were farming together and helping each other and resource sharing. And that's great. But, you know, to find people who are from the same cultural background who can talk about the food that we want to grow and the food that we want to eat, and talk about serving, you know, the communities that we come from, right? That's not really something that we can bond with other people about. And having the drive to really find new ways to serve our communities, I think that's something that you really, you know, you can only find with people of a similar background. But really informed Choi Commons as just a part of trying to look for Asian community in the Hudson Valley and trying to find a way for us all to work together because, it's lonely, you know, farming. And so, this was really a way for us to kind of gather the people who were from our community, in all different parts of the Hudson Valley and even New York City and see how we could work together on a project. We were really excited to form this group because it brings us together and it brings us together in service of mutual aid of each other's operations. Of each other's livelihoods and of serving the communities that we come from, that our parents are from, that have really brought us to where we are today.
Amanda Wong, the owner of Star Root Farm, started farming in 2017. Similarly to C, she wanted to connect with other Asian American farmers in the Hudson Valley. Doing so through Choi Commons has completely changed her perspective on growing food.
I never thought I would even be in a community with other farmers who looked like me, or even other people of color farmers, like back in 2017, which wasn't even that long ago. So I'm just like, which is really sad, but it's also really amazing, like the way I feel we've been able to position ourselves and work together and like stand for like this type of lifestyle and like be kind of like part of like the larger hope is that, you know, like the alienation and isolation that we experience won't be a part of everyone's experience as farmers after us. And like, I'm really hoping to make BIPOC agrarianism like a supportive, sustainable way of life that like currently definitely doesn't exist. And yeah, I feel like really similarly with Larry, where before I started doing kind of like mutual aid work and being mission based, that, you know, white, like most farming is done by white people for other white people. Mm-hmm. And that I felt super disconnected from all of the places that the food I was helping to grow was going to, and that felt super problematic. Mm-hmm. That, you know, like people that our food as like, you know, like the best quality vegetable only went to the highest bidder. And like, how can we operate in this world and not acknowledge that all of the like injustices and lack of just like lack of equity,
mm-hmm.
That is so inherent in our food system. And yeah, I just feel like my luck and the way I spiritually feel is so different now that I'm like, get to talk, be friends with Larry and Christina and Nicole and Kaya, and that we get to work together and build together.
Troy Commons is made up of three separate farms and operates a variety of programs. They focus on growing ancestral foods for Asian communities in New York City and redistributing resources to those in need. Prior to starting Troy Commons, both C and Wong felt a disconnect from the food they were growing and who they were growing it for. They designed their wholesale food program to provide affordable, culturally appropriate foods to the communities they came from.
Well, I think like the best thing is that we get to grow heritage products, heritage crops, and that people really enjoy them. And that I feel like the majority, probably like 80 or 90% of wholesale this year is going to distribution, like mutual aid distributions in Sunset Park and East Harlem, New York, and different Chinatowns, and like having direct connections with mutual aid groups that are also Asian focused has been so like, it's been really supportive, and it kind of just feels like a reciprocal relationship versus like one that's purely transactional.
You know, our communities, in New York City have always built their own supply chains, right? They've always been ignored by traditional supply chains, because they don't have the produce and the vegetables that our communities need and want to grow and cook. And so what we're doing is just kind of a continuation of that tradition, right? That these farms, Star Route and Troy Division, and Gentle Time, you know, they don't fit neatly into the distribution model, right? Like we have different needs as small farms and as hand scale farms. We have different price requirements and we have a different clientele. And so what we're building with the wholesale program is just a brand new supply chain from the ground up that is meant to serve these farms at this scale and for our communities. Not just restaurants, right? But also mutual aid groups, but also food pantries, right? That we're helping build these farms businesses, but also building our communities at the same time. Something that, you're not going to see that with a distributor, right? That this is really, really creating a distribution channel with a social mission.
Alongside the wholesale food program, connecting with community is a big priority for Troy Commons.
you know, in service of trying to bring more people out to the farm, and this is really, this comes out of a program that we were running our first year at Choi Commons, where we work with Asian Americans for Equality and brought elders from our community in Chinatown and East Harlem to Choi Division in Orange County for farm days. And so, you know, this really was to create that bridge between two generations, right? Between our elders and, you know, young farmers today. You know, this is agriculture is something that is really, important to the people in our community. And for our elders who have come to America, you know, they may have not, a lot of them have not been to a farm, you know, the entire time they've been here. I mean, there are some elders who haven't even left the city. And so, I mean, when you talk about like really powerful moments for us, I mean, that was really for me, just proof that what we're doing, you know, is making a difference, right? That you could see the joy in our elders' faces when they like came out and saw, you know, like Chinese green stem cauliflower being grown for the first time, right? And telling us how they used to grow it back in China, you know, before they left.
My dad was at the event and he was just like, he's from Chinatown, grew up on Elizabeth Street, like grew up like hopping rooftops to go home because it was too dangerous for him to walk home. And he was just like, what you guys are doing are things that me and my friends always wanted to do for our people, but we couldn't, we could only fight for our people with violence. And like back in my day, I couldn't even be up on First Avenue and 12th Street. Like we couldn't even like be over here. So it's just, I think for our parents and like generations before us, I don't even think they could really even imagine that's like there's even a handful of Asian farmers in New York, and a nonetheless group of people who are directly doing mutual aid work, and he's really proud of us.
Alongside sharing what they've built with their elders, Choi Commons wants to create a space where aspiring Asian American farmers feel welcome and can learn how to do things differently.
I think we want to show, you know, people who are looking at farming, to show young Asian people who are looking at farming in the Hudson Valley and even beyond, right? Not even just in New York and Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic, you know, across the country, that this is a viable model, that you can really be in concert with your community, that you can look outside the traditional bounds of capitalism, of just trying to find the highest bidder, right? And work together with people who share your values, and create a viable business. You know, what we want to create, right, is to create a wholesale program that has the reliability of purchasing from anyone else, but, you know, is really serving not just the three farms that we have right now, but 10 farms, but 20 farms, and we're replicating this across the state, replicating this across the region.
That was Larry C. and Amanda Wong of Choi Commons. In Liberty, I'm Marin Scotton for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, more stories from our spring and summer interns. This is Radio Catskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, what exactly is college for?
The monetary returns are really important, but that's just the tip of the iceberg.
And what are we missing when we pay so much attention to the elite schools at the top of the pyramid?
You're going to have more success if somebody's spending $100,000 on you than if they're spending $8,000 on you.
The first in a special series on higher ed, that's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
Join Radio Catskill for our annual Community Awards, September 12th, honoring local organizations and individuals dedicated to environmental stewardship and sustainability. Catskill Mountain Keeper, Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, Delaware Highlands Conservancy, Farm Arts Collective, and Seeds of Northeastern Pennsylvania. Help us celebrate their commitment to the environment at the 2024 Radio Catskill Community Awards, September 12th at La Sagone, Narrowsburg. Tickets at wjffradio.org.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, an effort to remind the country of the humanity in all of us. We are pairing up strangers in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania to have conversations, not debates. Sign up at wjffradio.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Delaware River is a major waterway and holds the distinction of being the longest free-flowing river in the eastern United States. The Delaware River Basin stretches across four states and supplies water for drinking, industry, and agriculture to portions of the Catskills, Hudson Valley, and New York City, among other major regions. A new documentary, A Flight Along the Delaware River, Our History, Our Watershed, aims to draw attention to the river's importance and the urgent need to protect it. Radio Catskill reporter and intern Chia Tien Nicole Chin spoke with Meg McGuire, the producer of the documentary and the founder and publisher of Delaware Currents.
As one of the few environmental journalists devoted to covering the Delaware River, Meg McGuire is no stranger to being the scrappy animating force behind an ambitious project. She founded the online news magazine Delaware Currents 9 years ago, and her most recent project has been 4 years in the making. It's a documentary titled A Flight Along the Delaware River, Our History, Our Watershed, and it was released on Delaware Currents at the end of May. It's a wide-ranging overview of the Delaware and its complex relationship to those of us who rely upon it. It's also a literal overview. It contains aerial footage of the Delaware, shot from planes that flew along its entire length. A lot of ground and water gets covered in the film's 19-minute runtime.
When I first decided that it might be interesting to write environmental stories, I had never done environmental stories. And the best way that I could see to cover the environment was to cover the Delaware. Now, when I first had that idea, I had no idea, like, how big the Delaware was, where it went, where it came from. And to be honest, it took about 2 years for me to realize that I really had a tiger by the tail. It's enormous and very complicated. And that's appealing to me as a journalist, you know, because I'm, you know, constantly sort of learning and unpicking things. It's never the same. It's always changing. And that's challenging. And I end up enjoying the challenge.
Speaking of enormous and very complicated, I was quite impressed by the scope, just how much she managed to cover in 19 minutes. There's geography, culture, economy, history, the infrastructure, the ecological importance, and all of the organizations surrounding the Delaware. And I mean, how did you determine that? You know, how did you decide what to include in this film?
Well, you're probably finding out already, if not you will by the end of this interview, that I can go on about the Delaware River. But it was the sort of focusing idea, the framing of it was, if someone were kind enough to sit down and watch the video and had very little idea of what the Delaware River was, what are the most important things for them to know? What arms them best to do what I'm hoping we do, which is protect our drinking water, right? Mm. And it's to some degree, you don't need to know about the big ships that, you know, come into the ports. I think there's 9 different ports on the Delaware. So in some ways, in order to protect the drinking water, you might say you don't need to know about the ports. But it is an economic engine of incredible importance south of Trenton. And although an organization like the DRBC doesn't tell the ships what they can or cannot do, on the other hand, the very fact that these big ships are in the water changes how we use the river, changes perhaps the river's water quality. I think what's fascinating when you look at a river like this and challenging is that it is made of complicated parts. It is the famous river that Washington crossed back in 17 whatever, the American Revolution. You know, so it has lots of ways into it. I think there are people who know the Delaware because they've kayaked on it or tubed on it, which is great. There are other people that know it because their company uses water from it. There's thousands of people employed in all the water utilities up and down the river. And it's sort of like trying to find the very tippy top of all of the things that you mentioned that sort of can join together as in a sort of a crazy quilt to understand what the watershed's all about.
And you paired all of this factual information with just the stunning footage of all, you know, 300 miles of the river. What do you think was the intended effect of the video?
What I would like is for people to respect the watershed and the water, to understand, like, the river does face problems. I reached out to the folks that were Lighthawk, which is a great organization. It offers to do flyovers with planes for free for environmental organizations. So I reached out to them, and then they started flying. And the whole watershed, the whole river, probably took 8 to 10 flights. Like, some people think it was a drone that did it.
Yeah.
No, it was planes. And this was a process that involved them using several different ways of taking this film while they were flying, and then having to unify those things when they came over to me. And I had to try and figure that out, and where they started and where they stopped and all that sort of stuff. I ended up having to use my stepson's computer because my computer simply couldn't carry the weight of all that. We never actually unified the whole thing because that would be about, I suppose it would be about a 3 or 4 hour video. Mm-hmm. And that might be a lot. When I was doing my beta work, testing this on audiences, most people said it was too long. And I said, it's as short as I can make it. If you can make our river less than 330 miles, I could probably make the video shorter. But in order to do it justice, it felt like it's got to be that length. And now the video is on my site. So that the whole point of the video is that it's free, that anybody can put it on their site. I encourage the advocacy groups to do that. I can go talk to people about the whole watershed. It's a funny thing. It's sort of like, as a journalist, you usually don't root for things. Mm-hmm. As a journalist, you're busy being very neutral. But I'm quite comfortable rooting for the watershed simply because I'm quite comfortable helping 14 million people preserve their drinking water.
You framed the importance of protecting the Delaware River as protecting your drinking water.
Right.
Right. But there are so many other facets.
Yes.
Would you want to name a few?
The environmental challenges for the watershed are as complex as they are all over the world. Water temperature rises, air temperature rises. If you think about the environmental impacts that affect the watershed, of course, water quality, right? The nasties that could be in our water. Water quantity, the possibility of floods. But then what's happening in the air? What level of toxicity is in the air that can really degrade people's living, especially if you're an environmental justice community that's very close to a factory or some sort of processing plant that exudes bad stuff. Suddenly your kids can't breathe as well as they should be able to because there's particulate matter in the air. The one reason I've chosen drinking water is, because I can only tolerate so much complexity, mm-hmm. but it's evident. It's like you turn on your tap, you can make your cup of tea. You know? That's an immediate connection, I think. Once you allow that door to open a little to the issue of drinking water quality and quantity, suddenly everything else starts, the puzzle pieces start pulling together, and you begin to see how all these possible problems need to be thought about and need solutions.
In both the film and just in everything you're saying today, you're repeatedly making the point that we all rely on the river, even if political boundaries or, you know, state borders or other divisions keep us from really grasping that, right? And I think you've talked about the intention of this documentary is to educate the public. But do you have sort of like an intended audience in mind?
Everybody who drinks Delaware River water. This is a time in our country where lots of things need attention. Let's just make it a very general statement like that. So lots of things that have to do with our shared civic life need attention. And then in people's individual lives, I think it's important for people to pay their bills. I think it's important to look after their kids. It's important to take care of their mom. I mean, there's a thousand things that are demanding people's time. And this doesn't feel, perhaps, to many people as urgent as it feels to me. Can I knock on somebody's forehead and say, pay attention to this? I'm not naive enough to say that that's going to happen.
I'm struck by the sort of very matter-of-fact tone of the video versus sort of how passionately you're speaking about the river in our conversation.
Well, that's intentional because if I'm talking to any one person or group of people, I feel I need to share that passion because I think that helps them be touched by it. But something like the video, I want it to go out there in a sort of a neutral way to be able to speak to all the people, right? The people who, I don't want to use any of the convenient terminology, the people who are shut down on climate change, I want to speak to them, right? The people that are absolute, you know, dyed-in-the-wool advocates and want everything to change yesterday, I want to speak to them. So the way to do it to me is to sort of find some sort of middle ground to have the beginning of a conversation and then bring our intelligence and passion to bear.
Thank you so much for talking to me today, Mike.
Great questions. Thank you for spending time with me. Thank you for taking my video so seriously. I appreciate it.
From Liberty, it's Jiatia Nicole Chen for Radio Catskill.
You can find the documentary A Flight Along the Delaware River, Our History, Our Watershed at DelawareCurrents.org. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Thank you to our intern reporters, Chiatia Nicole Chen and Marin Scotton. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Hi, I'm Bill Williams. Join me for the Kingfisher Project tomorrow when my guest will be Bob Lindsay, a lifelong recovery advocate whose work has benefited thousands of his fellow New Yorkers.
Addiction affects all of us, directly or indirectly, and as a result, we all bear some responsibility to do something about it.
That's the Kingfisher Project on the Local Edition, tomorrow night at 6, only on Radio Catskill.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3 on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Artist Cottage Bed and Breakfast, a newly renovated farmhouse that sleeps four with full gourmet cooked breakfast provided daily, located near the top of Hauk Mountain Road in the town of Walton. More information at greatwesterncatskills.com.
This is Radio Catskill, WJFF Jeffersonville. Listen local.